The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it was Battle of the Fans, not Battle of the Bands, at the Brooklyn Navy Yard last night. Can you pick a winner in the Bernie versus Hillary supporters shout-out from that debate? If all you used was an applause meter to measure the enthusiasm of each of these candidate supporters, you could tell this was a pretty crucial moment for both campaigns, but you would not be able to necessarily call it based on audience response. It was a room full of New York big shots and celebrities, and not necessarily a cross-section of the people who will be voting in Tuesday's all-important primary. Millennials are an earth-shaking demographic in marketing, media, fashion, and technology, but young people coming of age on the other side of Bill Clinton's bridge to the 21st century may not be so important as voters. Does the youthful message of Bernie Sanders bring millennials to the 2016 contest as a crucial constituency? Does being a woman help Hillary Clinton excite younger women voters? In all elections, young people vote at lower rates of participation than older voters, and a new poll released this week from ABC News and Refinery 29, it found that of women between the ages of 18 and 35, only 58% were certain they would vote in this presidential election. Neha Gandhi is Senior Vice President of Content Strategy and Innovation for Refinery 29, and Cleo Chang is a writer who appears in the New Republic and the Century Foundation, a progressive policy think tank. Neither of them found last night's debate particularly inspiring.
It started to feel so snippy. We're hearing the same things from the candidates in a lot of ways, and that conversation wasn't changing, but the tone had changed so much.
Weariness. Cleo, how about you?
Yeah, I would agree. I feel like I heard some of the same issues brought up again and again, and nothing was really changing, and they were getting much more adversarial.
And, you know, a cynicism and a skepticism of the political system in general is a feature of millennial voters of all kinds. But let's take a look at this ABC News and Refinery 29 poll on women between the ages of 18 and 35. But Neha, what does that tell you about the way it's breaking down for this group, critical group of voters?
I mean, there are some really interesting things we saw specifically in terms of how this group is going to vote. They're largely Bernie Sanders supporters. 35% of the women we spoke to are in favor of a Bernie Sanders presidency. But the part that's probably the most interesting is when you look at feminist voters. They are largely in favor of Sanders, and much more so than Clinton. The only place where you see them sort of even is actually when you look at women who don't identify as feminist, 24% Sanders, 24% Clinton, and then 27% GOP.
Why doesn't Hillary seem to get, Cleo, a credential as a feminist pioneer in any way? Because she's certainly fought some battles.
Right, definitely. I think that young women can see that, but they may not relate to Hillary in the same way that older generations might. Hillary's of a different generation, and she's, you know, while she's running on a more progressive policy than her husband did in the past, I think they're, you know, more attracted to the policies that Bernie is bringing to the table.
What is it about, I mean, because Bernie's not anywhere close to the millennial generation, is it Bernie makes the traditional workplace boss nervous with his economic policies, so that sort of shaking everything up idea makes these women more comfortable? Because, you know, you don't get the sense that Bernie has a natural voice to young women per se. Neha?
I think it's two things. There's one, there's this idea of big ideas. The people that are most interesting to me are the ones who are like, well, I'm going to either vote for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump because they have big ideas. Mm. And there's this feeling that it doesn't matter what the big idea is. But the other part is that I think Bernie Sanders from the beginning has been talking about the issue that is most important to millennials in general, whether they're men or women, and that is income inequality. That's been his platform. And he has real authority and credibility there with them, especially when they're younger and they're paying less in taxes.
Cleo, even though Hillary has, you know, campaigned on income equality between women and men for decades?
I mean, I think that if young women are looking at the policies that they're putting out now, you know, Bernie is certainly more progressive and he is fighting the income inequality battle in ways that Hillary is not. So I think for young women who are poorer in more fragile economic situations, it definitely makes sense.
Why would young women be more interested in the kind of class struggle framing of the income inequality argument, as Bernie Sanders does, than as a feminist question, as Hillary Clinton does?
I actually look at those as two different things. When we polled this audience, we saw 21% of them said income inequality is the issue for me, and then another 11% said equal pay for women. And I think that that comes from sort of their economic status. Millennials in general are, you know, 25% of them are living paycheck to paycheck. Or actually, I think the number is actually bigger than that. I think 25% of them are living below the poverty line. So this idea of the 1% is really sort of appealing to them. They can feel like a common enemy, I think, to a lot of younger voters in a way where you bifurcate the vote when you're looking at equal pay for men versus women.
Do you think millennials have this idea that they want their vote to upset the system, and that's an attraction to Bernie's candidacy and the Trump candidacy, Cleo?
I think definitely. We've been just seeing a lot of political gridlock over the past couple of years, and you know, I think a lot of millennials, this is the time that they're most politically, you know, growing into their political awareness. And that's definitely a huge issue that disillusions them with the idea of the same old, same old.
It's also the case that the young people typically vote at lower participation rates than other demographics. So there is a built-in cynicism about voting. And I think a built-in sense that I've got other things to think about than voting. Among young people, what in this campaign might cause that to change, Cleo?
I think the big ideas sort of thing, I think that might change things. You know, the idea that big policies are being put forth that could actually interest a young woman, I think that could help bring more voters out.
Do you think big ideas is the way this campaign is going to go? I mean, we heard both of you saying that it sounded like they were just sniping at each other in the debate. Where do you see the big ideas maybe coming back to the center stage in this campaign?
I mean, this may sound a little cynical, but I actually don't know if big ideas is going to be the story of the general. I think likely it will be Clinton versus Trump, Cruz. Let's see. But I think that what's really going to get a lot of people out to vote is a little bit of fear. I mean, when we talk to these women, there is this feeling that they're not inspired by the candidates. I think that there's some inspiration around big ideas, but when you look at the numbers, 47% of women told us that they don't find any of the candidates inspiring. There's an even larger number that says, no thanks, I wouldn't want to have dinner with any of them given the opportunity. I think that there is this disillusionment there, and if they turn out, it's likely going to be out of fear of something like a Donald Trump presidency.
You know, the irony here is that unlike a lot of incumbents in the past, President Obama has a strong identification with millennials, and that the status quo, if you look at Obama as the status quo, is very comforting to millennials. What's going on there, Neha?
I mean, I think that President Obama in 2008 was a message of hope, was the beacon of hope of change. I think that, you know, 8 years of being president sort of does diminish some of that. No matter what you think about what he's accomplished and what he's done, he doesn't have that same glean of hope in new and different. He has a little bit of the
fight
he's been having. Yeah, he's establishment. He's a fight with Congress now. He's someone who can't get along.
Do you think, Cleo, that Obama has seeded his message of hope in his 8 years of being at the center of the establishment, or is there some nostalgia for the Obama years as millennials look at these sniping candidates barking at each other?
Yeah, I would say yes to both. I think that it's hard to not see, you know, the gridlock battles that Obama has been fighting over the past couple of years. But, you know, when you look at a Ted Cruz or a Donald Trump, you know, Obama looks really great.
Neha Gandhi is Senior Vice President of Content Strategy and Innovation for Refinery29, an independent lifestyle website. And Cleo Chang is a writer whose work has been featured in The New Republic and the Century Foundation, a progressive policy think tank. When Bernie Sanders was a little boy in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Navy Yard was a bustling industrial site where thousands of workers built ships and worked the docks during wartime. Last night, it was a showcase for candidate Bernie Sanders and candidate Hillary Clinton and their competing visions for the nation. For Sanders, his appeal to young voters may be the only way he can win in his home state next Tuesday, and it showed.
The reason why in virtually every contest we are winning by very strong margins, younger people, and I'm not just talking about very young, you know, the older you get, the youngest, 45 or younger, is I think people are sensing that establishment politics and dependence on Wall Street and big money interest is really never going to address the crises that we face.
Hillary Clinton had this last chance to fight her reputation as an establishment Democrat. Her paid speeches from corporate events have become an issue throughout the campaign. And CNN debate moderator Dana Bash challenged Clinton on why she hasn't released the transcripts from speeches to Wall Street bankers.
It is your Democratic opponent and many Democratic voters who want to see those transcripts. It's not about the Republicans at this point. Let's set the same standard for everybody. When everybody does it, okay, I will do it. But let's set and expect the same standard on tax returns. Everybody does it, and then we move forward.
So much attention has been focused on the more chaotic and emotional GOP campaign that these Democratic candidates yearn to talk about issues that will certainly come up in the general election.
We've had 8 debates before. This is our 9th. We've not had one question about a woman's right to make her own decisions about reproductive health care. Not one question. And in the meantime, we have states, governors, doing everything they can to restrict women's rights. We have a presidential candidate by the name of Donald Trump saying that women should be punished.
The debate was billed as real candidate-to-candidate combat, and there were moments.
When you were Secretary of State, you also worked hard to expand fracking to countries all over the world. But the issue here, of course the agreement is a step forward, but you know agreements and I know agreements, there's a lot of paper there. We've got to get beyond paper right now. Does Secretary Clinton have the experience and the intelligence to be a president? Of course she does. But I do question her judgment. I question a judgment which voted for the war in Iraq, the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of this country.
It's the judgment of New York State voters that's going to matter most, though, in the short term as they go to the polls on Tuesday. For both parties, New York State will either clarify the front runners or muddy the waters. Stay tuned.
We need a candidate.
So the truth of the matter is,
it's going to be a real deal.
I'm proud of the campaign.
And I kind of think that before it's all said and done, I'll be the nominee.
On both sides of the aisle, the New York primary could push both party conventions into delegate stalemates, or it could push some candidates out for good. And in this rough and tumble campaign, political comedians would be sad to see any of the faces go. Comedian and commentator Jimmy Tingle says it's almost as though politics has become its own comedy channel in 2016. Tingle's one-person show, Jimmy Tingle for President, the funniest campaign in history, mocks the system and the candidates, but Tingle says never has fear so dominated the messages of the candidates and the laugh lines of the comedians.
First of all, in order for the opposing party to get into office, to regain the White House, you have to make the case that everything's terrible. So why else would people want to switch gears or change teams, right? That's part of it, the natural inclination to, you know, make the other side look more horrible or worse than they are, make the economy look worse than it is, to constantly emphasize the negative, all the things that haven't happened, all the things that are going wrong. But so much of what's happened in this country right now is trending in a positive direction. Not everything, but a lot of things are trending in a positive direction. For example, Americans are living longer and healthier lives than ever before. They say 60 is old as the new 40. I love that. 80 is the new 60. I love that. 100 is the new 80. I love that. And the afterlife is the new assisted living. So we have that to look forward to. And John, I don't know if you know this, but 5 years ago, I went back to school, got a master's degree. And I just want to say the great thing about going back to school in your 50s, you get the student ID and the senior discount.
And that turned you into a Republican or a Democrat?
It made me more aware of how many good people there are in this country doing positive things in a whole host of industries. And it made me more, I would say, open to other people's ideas and open to just the political discourse. I watched all the debates, and I try to be objective, but the amount of negativity is just, it's overwhelming.
But I don't see why you would be madder today than you would be in 2008 when the whole global economy was about to fall off a cliff, or madder than 2004 when you had two wars that were complete fiascos, Abu Ghraib pictures all over the place. That's mad. Vietnam War, 50,000 or more dead. That's some anger. The Cold War, I mean, the Reagan era, I mean, anger. Yeah. Okay, I get it, but 2016?
John, I'm not saying it's justified. I'm just saying those are the reasons, the contributing factors. There's so much disinformation out there in the media. People don't know what to believe. And that's why the Tingle administration, had I been elected, John, I would have mandated a bull detector for the public airwaves. So somebody makes a political statement, you fact check the information. If the information is correct, you allow the tape to proceed. If it's inaccurate, a little jingle comes on. Liar, liar, pants on fire. And a little bull trots out on the screen and takes a lap around the person's head. And then they're fined for the infraction because it's a product. These people are selling a product. They're selling their political campaigns and their political careers as a product. And if you went on television and said, this beer has no calories in it, and if you did a chemical analysis of the beer and there were 500 calories in the beer, you would be fined, you would be sued, there would be some sort of ramifications. There's no consequences right now for disinformation on the public airwaves, whether it's television debates, commercial radio, or wherever. But I agree with you, and I agree with the quote by Martin Luther King, that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Donald Trump running for president, a few steps backwards. That's just the way it goes.
Sometimes, but not for humorists. I mean, for people who make their living with comedy, I mean, Trump is an asset or no?
Well, put it this way. I saw him in front of his supporters recently. He said, if you elect me as your president, your lives will improve dramatically. And I have to say, as a comedian, that's definitely true. He is definitely an asset. Let's face it, the guy's very entertaining. He was asked, you know, why he thinks he's been audited 12 times over the last 12 years. And he said, I don't know, maybe it's my strong Christian faith. I don't think so. I really don't think that's what's driving the audits. I don't see anywhere in the Bible where it says, and the Lord said, build a wall across the southern border.
What about Bernie Sanders? What explains the Brooklyn burn becoming such an anger generator within the Democratic Party? Hillary Clinton seemed to have this sewed up a year ago.
I don't think it is anger. I mean, I think in terms of Bernie Sanders, I think you see a man that's committed to certain principles, who's been in the political game for 35, 40 years. He's been a mayor, a congressman, a senator. He sees the influence of money. He sees what's happened to wages. Wages are stagnated. Companies have moved offshore. He's articulating that to people who are thousands of dollars in debt from student loan. The people aren't making the money they used to make. Or put it this way, everything's more expensive. The wages have gone up. Yeah, they've gone up, you know, but relative to what things cost, not as much, obviously. So I don't think he's angry, and I don't think his people are really necessarily angry. I just think they're aware of what's happening. He's given people an opportunity to vote for a change. And that doesn't take anything away from Hillary Clinton. You know, I think she's incredibly qualified and very strong and stable. And I've heard Republicans say this, is ready on day one to walk into the White House and to be able to do the job.
Jimmy, thanks so much.
Great, man. Thanks for having me on.
Jimmy Tingle is a comedian and commentator. We spoke to him from our partner station, WGBH, in Boston. Talking about freedom, has your religious liberty ever come under attack? Has religion ever infringed on your freedom? How? Chicago, Illinois. No to both. I refuse to allow anyone to impinge on my faith. I refuse to allow my religion to impinge on my morals and or ethics.
My name's Corey from Austin. My religious freedom has never come under attack. I was raised Christian and no longer ascribe to Christianity or any religion for that matter. What I see is the exact opposite. People cry out when modern social rights considerations insult their religion. Nowhere in the Bible does Jesus call for Christians to inundate the political arena to force all of us, quote-unquote, sinners, to succumb to their will.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio, making a picture again.
It was a bilious piece of dirt that made me cry out in pain.
Did you say it was a brilliant piece of work and you'll fly me out to Spain?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
Yes, is The Exorcist a comedy? Who knows the answer to that? Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and here on Friday. Hey there, Rafer.
Hey, John.
So, The Jungle Book, let's listen to a clip.
Relax, kid. No need to get worked up, okay?
Where am I?
This is a cave. It's my cave. You don't remember what happened, do you?
No.
I saved your life. Yeah, I snatched you from the jaws of death, the coils of death, if you will. And lucky for you, your new favorite hero, Old Blue here, just happened to be passing by.
Now, the voice of Bill Murray pulls this away from Kipling,
yeah.
Traditional Kipling. But what do you think of this?
Well, this is Disney's remake, their right. Sort of live-action slash computer-generated remake of the 1967 Jungle Book, which is one of my favorite Disney movies.
And very successful.
Yeah, and a beloved film. This is a much darker, much scarier Jungle Book. It's much more of a action adventure. The villain Shere Khan, who's got the voice of Idris Elba, much scarier than he was in the original. The animation, this photoreal animation, these animals with the fur and the eyes and the way they move, there's really been nothing like it on the screen. I mean, the animation makes everything else you've seen look like the Flintstones or something. It's astounding.
And in 3D, it's worth seeing.
I would say this might be one of the few times where the 3D is really worth the premium. It's an amazing visual film. I do feel that they've toyed a little bit with the ending of the film in a way that I didn't appreciate, a way that I thought the original film handled better.
But you won't give it away.
I won't spoil it, but it's a pretty incredible movie, but I do think if you're a parent and you want to take kids to it, it's PG, and it's PG for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Number two is the movie Criminal. Let's hear a clip.
Your name is Bill Pope.
I'm sick, Doc. I need some kind of shot. I need something.
Don't look at him. Don't look at him. He can't help you. Only you can help you. Your name is Bill Pope. You're an intelligence officer for the CIA.
Is that Kevin Costner trying to resurrect his career again?
That is indeed. It's Kevin Costner. He's not playing Bill Pope. He's playing Jericho Stewart. He's a felon, psychotic, multiple murderer who has been implanted with the memories of a CIA agent named Bill Pope, played by Ryan Reynolds briefly. And so now he's got Bill Pope's memories swirling around in his head. This is, you know, action thriller, very violent, more violent than I think you usually see in a thriller like this, even though it's R-rated. I will say that's pretty generic, you know, pretty junky action stuff, which I happen to like. Kevin Costner is actually really great in this movie.
Really?
Yeah, he's really
so worth
fun.
Seeing.
You know, he plays this very, he's playing against type, this very angry, bad guy, basically. Great scene where he staves in someone's skull and then screams over the lifeless corpse.
Delightful.
Almost worth the ticket price there.
The Cube is back in Barbershop, The Next Cut.
You girls keep complaining about the chauvinistic talk in the shop, but y'all do the same thing in reverse. Each one of y'all want a super thug that can hold his own on the yard at the Cook County Jail, that's got 3 degrees from Harvard and making 6 figures.
You know.
Meanwhile, you pass up corny dudes like Gerard every day.
I think Ice Cube is making 6 figures, but what will people who loved the first one think of this?
I think this is very much in keeping with the spirit of the entire Barbershop franchise. For better or for worse, I've always thought these films could be a little better made, a little better written. But I think what you go to these movies for is really to see all these great people, Ice Cube, Cedric the Entertainer, just sort of sit around in that shop and banter. And if you can enjoy that, I think you'll enjoy the movie. It's a lot of fun.
Barbershop on a Saturday afternoon sounds traditional. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
You too, John.
If movies aren't exactly what you fancy this weekend, do the culture wizards have anything for Dorothy and the rest of us?
Oh, I don't think there's anything in that black bag for me.
Never fear, Dorothy. Our own culture wizard, Melissa Locker, who has written for Time and The Guardian, has a great find for some happy downtime this weekend.
Do you miss Downton Abbey?
You know, I miss liking it in its early days. I don't miss being sick of it because I eventually got sick of it.
Well, then I have the perfect remedy for you.
Yes.
I have the show that is kind of the complete opposite of Downton Abbey. It is called My Mad Fat Diary. It just premiered on Hulu. It was big in the UK for a while, but didn't get picked up in the US until last weekend.
And so what's the premise? It's like making fun of everything bizarre and weird about Brits?
It is the real-life diary of a teenage girl who is sprung from a mental hospital and given the requirement that she has to write a diary. Her name is Ray Earle, and she lives in a council flat in Lincolnshire, England, and she's overweight, as the title of the TV show suggests, a teenager, and she's just kind of unhappy. But for the most part, it is about her relationship with her other teen friends and with her mother.
Dear Diary, I'm 16, I weigh 16 and a half stone, and I live in Lincolnshire.
My interests include music, vegging out and finding a fit boy, don't scratch that, any boy, to quench my ever-growing horn. Unfortunately, I already have a lover that makes me look pregnant. Food.
And if anyone ever finds this diary and reads it and comes to the conclusion that I'm crazy, they'd be spot on.
A boyfriend called Food.
Exactly. So it's. I think it's such a great show because it's kind of the classic teenage drama, something a little more thinky than a lot of shows would be. Sort of My So-Called Life meets The In-Betweeners meets
Shameless.
Yeah, a little bit of Shameless. It's just a teenage girl struggling to find herself with all these things battling against her. And she's such an intriguing character, and she's not like anything you really see on TV.
And here's an interaction with her mom.
Oh, I'm on the alphabet diet.
The what?
Each week, you only eat food beginning with a certain letter. Makes you rotate all your food types. This week, it's W.
So you've nearly done the entire alphabet?
No, I started on S because I bought a load of Scotch eggs on the cheap. So I've lost 6 pounds, though.
I mean, this is the essential point of being British is you could be absolutely serious about something that's completely pointless, which is what Downton Abbey was about. This is just a different sort of class.
Right. This is kind of the complete opposite of Downton Abbey in that there's not refined manners. Like, there's scenes where Ray is just scarfing down every single thing in her sight. There's scenes with swimsuits and with, you know, an inflatable alligator that is quite memorable. And then she and her mom battle it out every day.
Ray, this is Kareem, my lover. Isn't he something?
Pleased to meet you.
Why were you in the boot? No, well, he can't speak much English. He speaks Arabic and French. That's what they speak in Tunisia.
Why was he in the chuffing boot?
Look, well, look, he hasn't done anything wrong, but there are people looking for him.
What people?
Immigration. Now, no one can know about this. Not just for now. Is that okay, Rachel?
Little edgy for what's going on here right now.
Right, but, you know, it's just immigration. He hasn't done anything.
Right, of course.
Keep that in mind.
Yeah.
But her mom comes to pick her up at the asylum, and she surprises them when they pull into their little council flat by popping up in the trunk, and there's a full-grown man in it. And she's like, this is my boyfriend. So it's kind of on that background that Ray has all of these issues and trying to lead a normal teenage life and trying to balance, like, her mental health with living with his mom who's not really helping the situation and, you know, normal teenage things like find a boyfriend.
Is this bingeable or is this one episode at a time?
Oh, it's totally bingeable. The first time I started watching it, I watched about five of them in a row.
Do you have to eat a bowl of Oreos while you're watching?
You will occasionally want to dive in while Ray's binging, but she also makes binging look as bad as it is. So, yes and no. It may want you, make you want like a Cadbury flake or a Scotch egg or, you know, something very British.
The multiple layers of binging with our friend Melissa Locker. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Locker is a culture reporter who has written for The Guardian and Time, among many others.
What is freedom?
Freedom of speech.
At this point, free speech is nothing more than a nuisance.
Freedom of worship.
Wake up, Christian America. You are being mocked.
Freedom from want.
We would actually go in Walmart and clean ourselves up before we go to
sleep. Yeah, in the bathroom.
Save some money.
Freedom from fear.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
All this week, with you and with some very interesting guests, we've been examining the legacy and the state of President Roosevelt's 1941 Four Freedoms.
In the future days which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. Everywhere in the world. The third, freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear.
You hear how he says everywhere in the world, President Roosevelt was articulating a mission for the United States globally. And we've spoken to a Japanese-American about her particular freedom from fear, a Catholic priest about his notion of freedom from want in our time, an openly gay African-American journalist about freedom of speech. We've heard from you who've been a part of the conversation. And you've told us that in our time, the four freedoms have evolved to be in conflict in certain ways, especially freedom of worship and freedom of speech and expression.
This is Holly from Portland, Oregon. Religion has infringed on my life because of my sexual orientation. My own religion has not been curtailed, but I'm a member of a Christian denomination, which is considered normal in our country. Some of us forget that our freedoms should apply to everyone, and to try to pick and choose who is protected is dangerous and un-American and unpatriotic. These have been fought for, and our citizens have died for these freedoms. Don't abridge them.
Passionate voices. A lot of you think of fear as fear of what the government can do to restrict us. From Missouri, freedom from fear embodies the idea that as Americans, we should not have to fear the unknown or anything else. I believe it is the freedom we should strive for most because it makes our society more open and welcoming. And without the freedom from want, life in poverty can be a prison without any rights.
My name is Becky. I'm calling from Minneapolis. I've been poor as a child and as an adult. Growing up, there were times we didn't have electricity or food for extended periods. My mom relied on us getting fed at school and by our great aunt sometimes the water would get turned off, and we'd take showers at friends' houses or sheepishly ask our aunts. Our dad would purposely withhold child support to spite our mom. And my sister and I will now be taking the recent proceeds from selling his house to help pay for our mom's medical care.
This is Walter from Ithaca, New York. I have a real concern about free speech, what appears to be a growing trend on college campuses to prohibit speakers who may have a view that conflicts with someone else's view on the campus or maybe upset them. But it is important to have all views be heard, and I think that's a very unfortunate trend.
Again, the idea that these freedoms are in conflict in some way. Here's Tony Acosta of Provo, Utah on Anchor, who's worried about the freedom to innovate in an increasingly restricted economy.
First of all, the freedom that I'm most grateful for is the freedom to be able to build something. As an entrepreneur, living in a country that doesn't tell me what I can and can't do and gives me the freedom to build upon my passion is probably something that I'm super grateful for. As far as a freedom that is in danger, for me, it's freedom of religion, just because I feel like in today's day, a lot of those beliefs are no longer respected.
Freedom hangs like heaven over everyone. Ain't nobody knows about a newborn hose, but his papa gonna cry, shaking bristling and shaking like bone.
Today we're going to conclude our look at FDR's four freedoms, though, with a look at how much religious freedom seems to be in conflict with other rights. It's something you've talked about.
Hello, John. This is John Coughlin from Honolulu, Hawaii. And the freedom I cherish most is the freedom from the tyranny of religion.
My name is Kate. I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I had to wait 2 days here in Virginia for a wanted and well-thought-out abortion due to the religious beliefs of others. These are beliefs the New Testament doesn't even state.
My name is Pax. I live in Augusta, Georgia. And a lot of communal events that happen here are based on congregations or just religion in general. I believe that freedom of religion should include freedom from religion.
It's certainly likely that Roosevelt didn't foresee any of these complications when he slowly and deliberately dictated his now famous speech on the four freedoms to advisor Sam Rosenman back in January of 1941, even though he insisted that the freedoms were a fundamental right of all the world's citizens. And yet, if FDR had no way of knowing how America's makeup would change between his time and ours, his bold vision for the freedom of every person to worship God in his own way is one that resonates deeply with Chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Daoud Agbery of the U.S. Army. He's a Ghanaian immigrant and a Muslim chaplain in the Army.
You are really talking about a fundamental issue in people's lives. For most people, it is the religion that informs their values, that informs their worldview. So their decisions and actions are informed by these values they get from their faith tradition. So it is very, very important for us, also in the military, that our soldiers who are putting their life on the line have the right to exercise this freedom. And that is the very essence of the chaplaincy that we talk about in the military. Our goal and our mission is to ensure that soldiers who fight for our many freedoms also exercise and enjoy the very freedom they fight for other people, and religion is one of those. As a Muslim chaplain, I have found myself actually in even some situation where I'm the only Muslim in the unit, and yet I'm able to share with other soldiers this very freedom that we cherish so much.
Chaplain Agbery has dedicated the last 20 years or so of his life to helping American soldiers of all religious traditions exercise their right to freedom of worship. Muslims were not envisioned as part of that freedom to worship in the U.S. military in Roosevelt's time in 1941, and yet that is a core value in the U.S. military today. Coming up, more of our conversation with Chaplain Agbery. That's next on The Takeaway. When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt outlined the four freedoms that America would fight for back in 1941 as the president prepared this country for an expected entrance into World War II, there was much freedom to be fought for yet in America's struggle to make good on all of its promises from 1776. Today we hear from Muslim chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Daoud Agbery of the U.S. Army. A promise fulfilled, freedom of worship, in his 20-year career has been fulfilled in the army. And here he is to talk about it.
In 1941, Islam may not have actually crossed the mind of the president. But today, just like other minority faith groups, today Islam is front and center in our discussions in this country. So as a Muslim chaplain, if I find myself being a Muslim chaplain within a community that probably will consider me as a minority, it speaks a lot about this, the greatness of this country, a country where everyone can belong, everyone can feel that they are part and parcel of the fabric of their society. So yes, I'm walking out there and I may be the only Muslim, but I can identify with the soldiers what their mission is, and they can identify with me as one of them who really is there for them.
Has a Muslim or even a Christian soldier come to you ever in the course of your work during these conflicts in the Middle East and said, sometimes I feel the United States is against Islam, sometimes I feel the United States is intolerant of Islam? Or has a Christian said, sometimes I feel as though Islam is the enemy of the United States? How have you dealt with those things?
So soldiers have their own feelings, and often it's not that they are really questioning as much as they are exploring. But yes, people do have struggles, and they will come and they want to figure out, you know, what is going on? Can you help me understand all of these issues you are facing? So, but when you lay it down and you are able to explain to them what the differences are, what the challenges are, what are the causes, and often they will end up realizing, even though religion seems to be the root of a lot of these challenges, then they come to realize actually religion is just a foil for all of what is happening. But at the root of it are a lot of issues, whether it's cultural issues, whether it's tribal issues, whether they are political or even basically economic issues. But religion is a very strong force to use to rally people. So those are the things you explain to soldiers, and then they begin to see the big picture and begin to understand that, yes, we may be talking about religion, but there is more to what we are talking than what is really happening on the ground.
How does your experience here in the United States differ from where you grew up?
So that is a very interesting question, because I grew up in Ghana, West Africa, where actually the tribe is what really drives a lot of issues. And within your household, you can have some of your families are Muslims, some of the families are Christians, or even traditional African religion. So, you know, it's so surprising you come to America and just the crescent on your uniform means a lot. But the unique things about America is the fact that everybody can belong. Everybody can belong. So, I mean, I go to places, and if they get to know that I'm a chaplain in the U.S. Army, I mean, even the very idea that somebody from Ghana, West Africa, with this big accent, will be a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, it surprises people. And I have been in this army now for about 17 years, and I have had nothing but to be grateful. I have had soldiers who will not even talk to, they know I'm a Muslim, and they will not talk to a Christian chaplain because I am their chaplain.
So as a Muslim cleric, the emphasis is on scholarship, but in the army, that's where you learned pastoral care?
Absolutely. As a Muslim cleric, as a Muslim chaplain, most of my education is more about scholarship. What does the Quran say? What does the tradition say? The army is not employing me to tell soldiers, you know, this is wrong. The army is employing me to find a solution to what I think is wrong. And that is the difference. That is where pastoral care comes in. I can stand out there and say, hey, adultery is not good. Infidelity is not good. But infidelity may be a disease. You have diagnosed it. What is the solution to it? That is where the chaplain comes in. How can we help that soldier to overcome suicidal thoughts? How can we help that soldier to overcome financial challenges? How can we make that soldier a good husband, a good wife? And that is the challenge that the army throws at you. But as I said, the army will help train you, but you also then find from that training what you can use in addition to your faith tradition to become a better caregiver.
So you're a caregiver, and you're one of the very few Muslims in the U.S. military, and you're also an immigrant. And your understanding of American freedoms is not the same as my understanding. But I'm wondering if, as a chaplain in the Army, and as a Muslim chaplain in the Army, that you find yourself as someone who's out there not only protecting the soldiers, but protecting that freedom of worship that Roosevelt talked about 75 years ago.
One thing people don't realize, if you go out there and fight and stand with that soldier for their religious freedom, you are actually standing for your own religious freedom. Because once that soldier loses their freedom, you are going to lose yours. So we are working and fighting for the right of soldiers to exercise the freedom that this country has guaranteed them. And in doing so, we are actually fighting for our own freedom. This is a very unique country when it comes to a lot of these freedoms. I can absolutely tell you, there are Muslims in this country who really enjoy being Muslims in this country than maybe from where they came from. Absolutely. They have the freedom here to be better Muslims because nobody is forcing it on them. Nobody is imposing it on them. They are doing it because they think it's the right thing to do. They are doing it out of their own conscience. Whereas where they came from, they are likely doing it because somebody is forcing them to do it. And I think the beauty of faith, the beauty of religion is when you practice it because it is what you believe in. It's not what somebody thinks you have to do.
So 75 years after Roosevelt's speech enumerating the freedom to worship, that freedom, you believe, is alive and well.
Absolutely, regardless of what others want us to believe. And actually, here at the Pentagon, where I am currently, the Pentagon chaplain is where we meet every Friday for our Friday services. That is where the Jewish community meets, the same building. You have Muslims praying in that building. You have the Jewish praying in that same building. And you have the Christians also praying in this same chapel. One chapel is accommodating all of us, and everybody have their time of allotted to them for their service.
Well, Chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Daoud Agberi, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Lieutenant Colonel Daoud Agberi, for 17 years, has been a chaplain in the U.S. Army. We want to thank everyone who participated in the Four Freedoms discussion all week long here on The Takeaway. And here's one for you for the weekend. It's kind of a happy thought. Scientists have figured out one of the great mysteries of the monarch butterfly migration. Its journey from Mexico to Canada. Monarchs cannot survive cold winters, but using environmental cues, the monarchs somehow know when it's time to travel south for the winter. We identified that the input cues depend entirely on the sun, explained one of the scientists who published in the journal Cell. Scientists hope to mimic the navigation and produce robotic versions of monarch butterflies to track their migration. Oh, won't that be cute? Again, find us on iTunes or any service you use to get your podcasts. You can give us your take at 8778MyTake or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.